Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, December 15th, 2024. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Mary Louise Barden, no age given, of Kalispell, Montana; James R. Bowl, Jr., 90, of Scottsdale; Valerie Kealoha Buck, no age given, of Maricopa; Anna D'Alessio, known as Nina or Nina, 83, of Phoenix. And then there was Constance Di Benedetto, 91, of Portland, Maine; Freddie Gabriel, 58, of Scottsdale; Mindy Nicole Gambino, known as Mimi, no age given, of the Valley; Eileen Goodwin, 79, of Phoenix; Thomas Charles Holverson, 89, of Scottsdale; Tom Pike Johnson, 83, of Phoenix; June Mildred Klein, 102, of Gilbert, Arizona; Ralph Mong Moreno, 72, of Tolleson; Harriet Ann O'Connor, 68, of Phoenix; Duane Marilyn O'Donnell, known as Dewey, 84, of Phoenix; Betty O'Melia, no age given, of Phoenix; Marilyn Ruth Poppy, 83, of Paradise Valley; Jacqueline Olive Rank, 79, of Phoenix; and Duane Edward Smith, 81, of Phoenix; and finally, Neil Vandenberg, 85, of Phoenix. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individuals listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. There's one article today. It was entitled, "Farmers Could Lose Billions in Trade War." This was written by Rick Barrett for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, part of the USA Today network, and it comes out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Here's what Rick wrote. If President-elect Donald Trump ignites a trade war with China, Mexico, and Canada, many farmers in Wisconsin and beyond may find themselves caught in the crossfire. U.S. agriculture has not fully recovered from a trade fight that Trump started in his first administration when he imposed higher tariffs, essentially a tax, on $370 billion in products from China. The Chinese government retaliated with countervailing tariffs on up to 25% on more than $100 billion worth of U.S. products, targeting soybeans, beef, pork, wheat, corn, and sorghum. It then turned to Brazil and other countries rather than the United States for those commodities. American farmers lost $27 billion in export sales in 2018 and 2019, largely due to the Chinese tariffs, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, even now, the share of China's soybean imports from the U.S., that's the top American export to China, well, it was 40% in 2016, but it has now dropped to 18% in November. So with Trump threatening more trade sanctions, farmers could again suffer market losses. Dairy farmer Tina Hinchley, a board member of Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, said, quote, "We have played the tariffs game before," unquote. Well, unintended consequences of trade wars create hardship for rural Americans, already stressed from economic forces beyond their control. Hinchley said, quote, "When farms go out of business, other businesses close, and schools close, and churches close, because farmers are the backbone of everything," unquote. Now, some Republicans say that Trump's tariffs will help pressure America's trading partners into more favorable deals. They point to an agreement that he signed with China in 2020, which helped end the 2018 trade war and boosted sales of U.S. agricultural products. Many farmers are encouraged by Trump returning to the White House, according to a November survey from Purdue University. A third of those surveyed said they expect their farm's finances to improve next year. Looking ahead 5 years, 52% predicted widespread prosperity for U.S. agriculture. However, 42% indicate they believe likely or very likely that agriculture could face a trade war, potentially leading to a significant decline in exports. Chinese retaliatory tariffs can have damaging effects with permanent consequences, according to the American Soybean Association and the National Corn Growers Association. They had a study evaluating the impact that a trade war would have on farmers. So Trump had said he would impose a 25% tariff on all products coming into the United States from Mexico and Canada. This tariff will remain in effect until such time as drugs, in particular fentanyl, and all illegal aliens stop this invasion of our country, unquote. That's what he said on his social media platform, Truth Social. Well, Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum Pardo, responded with a warning that Trump's plan would cause more inflation and hurt American businesses, like automakers that rely on Mexican assembly plants. Pardo said, quote, "The response to one tariff will be another until we put at risk the companies that we share. Yes, that we share," unquote. So the proposed tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China, the three main export destinations for U.S. dairy, are likely to reduce dairy exports to a degree that would harm farm milk prices and processor profitability. That's according to Charles Nicholson, an associate professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Wisconsin farmers have come to rely on exports for selling beef and pork, soybeans, cranberries, cherries, ginseng, and dairy products. But in another trade war, farmers may once again find themselves at the mercy of federal government programs that act as a safety net when commodity prices fall. The National Foundation for American Policy said in their study in 2020, quote, "The amount of money raises questions about the strategy of imposing tariffs and permitting the use of taxpayer money to shield policymakers from the consequences of their actions," unquote. Well, over the next 5 years, hundreds of millions of dollars could be funneled into efforts to help farmers preserve their soil, produce alternative fuels, and reduce the 10% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions that come from agriculture. And that's if Congress passes a farm bill that includes significant funding for climate-smart farming practices. Some lawmakers have sought to eliminate that funding in the five-year legislation. Launched in the depths of the Great Depression, the Farm Bill has become the single largest piece of federal legislation supporting the livelihoods of farmers across the nation. It assists farmers with risk, provides payments for many crops, and funds efforts to protect farm soil and water. A significant portion of the funding, about 80%, goes to low-income families to buy food through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP. The current Farm Bill, signed into law in Trump's first term, has expired, but Congress has yet to produce a new plan. And until that happens, the current one will likely be extended into next year. Lawmakers will also be eyeing Project 2025. That's a plan for conservative political leadership, which may influence farm policies. Project 2025, according to an analysis done by Slattery, seeks to eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to implement a renewable fuels standard for corn-based ethanol. Well, around 40% of U.S. corn is grown for use as ethanol in vehicle fuel. And without that market, farmers could expect lower corn prices and reduced income. A significant number of farms, Slattery said, would be pushed into bankruptcy. And that was the article, "Farmers Could Lose Billions in Trade War." Well, we're at 10 minutes past the hour. Time for us to move on over to the sports section. Our cover story on the sports section was written by Michelle Gardner. Big 12 should be rooting for ASU. Everybody associated with the Big 12 should be rooting for the Arizona State Sun Devils with a record of 11 wins and 2 losses. And that's when they take the field for the Peach Bowl in Atlanta on January 1st. And they will play against either Clemson with a record of 10-3 or Texas with a record of 11-2. Now, other coaches, players, and fans as well. And yes, that means even fans of longtime nemesis Arizona, for whom that will be hard. The Big 12 took a beating this year in terms of perception. It says a lot that the Mountain West champion Boise State was ranked ahead of the Sun Devils each week when the college football rankings were released. Incidentally, Boise State is at 12 wins and 1 loss. The stakeholders from the Big 12 were fuming. Why should a team whose best game on its schedule was losing to Oregon in Week 1 be slotted ahead of a Big 12 team that defeated 4 nationally ranked foes? What better way to change the narrative than to beat a team from the almighty SEC, Texas, or maybe one of the premier brands in the ACC, Clemson? The Big 12's reputation was so bad that late in the season, there was the possibility the conference would not get a team in the 12-team field at all. Really? Only the top 5 highest-ranked conference champions were guaranteed a berth, and one had to be a Group of 5 school. But that doesn't mean there couldn't be 3 Power 4 champions and 2 Group 5 of representatives. Tulane, out of the American Athletic Association, was ranked number 18th. That was just 4 spots behind ASU in the Week 14 poll. Had the Green Wave not lost to Memphis, it might have challenged the Big 12 winner for a spot. Yes, that would have been an atrocity. But the possibility was out there. Part of the reason the Big 12's reputation took a hit was that the teams expected to be the contenders struggled mightily. The top 5 in the preseason poll were Utah, Kansas State, Oklahoma State, Kansas, and Arizona. 3 of those finished in the bottom 4 of that 16-team conference, Kansas and Kansas State located in the middle of the pack. Little old ASU was picked last, so of course the conference was down, rather than ASU being a quality team that proved itself with a 45-19 beatdown of Iowa State in the Big 12 title game last week at AT&T Stadium in Arlington, Texas. It was the biggest margin of victory in any conference title game, and Iowa State was no slouch. The Big Ten ended up with 4 teams in the field. The SEC had 3 teams, and the ACC had 2. Of course, the SEC is whining because that's all those schools do. Cue the outrage that, for once, Alabama didn't get in. That's a 3-loss Alabama team that dropped games to 500 foes Vanderbilt and Oklahoma. Oklahoma was by 21 points. And whose non-conference schedule included Western Kentucky, South Florida, and Mercer. Miami, which didn't even make its conference title game, was the other team that was bumped when the dust had settled. But let's get back to the disrespect for the Big 12. ASU received a first-round bye, not only because Clemson upset SMU in the ACC championship game, knocking SMU out of a top-4 spot. Had that game finished the other way around, ASU would be hitting the road for a first-round game next weekend. And there is still no logic for Boise being the number 3 seed and ASU the number 4. Besides the strength of the conference, ASU dominated its conference title game by a bigger margin on a neutral field than Boise did in its title game on its own Smurf turf. Yeah, many have sounded off. Well, yes, it's mostly the Big Ten and the SEC talking heads. That the field should just be seeded with 12 teams and put the conference champions in the pecking order however the committee feels appropriate. There likely will be talk after this playoff pans out as to tweaks to the current format. But for now, ASU is in the top 4 spot with a chance to strike a blow for the conference. The Sun Devils have won 6 straight games, and the last loss at Cincinnati came with their starting quarterback sidelined with a rib injury. The signs of disrespect have been nonstop. ESPN's College Day analyst Desmond Howard wondered why the ASU-Kansas State game was a big deal when the teams were playing with first place on the line. And the hits keep coming. The latest with ASU called the worst CFP team ever. Well, no doubt Kenny Dillingham has collected more than enough bulletin board material to motivate his squad. His team has thrived in the role of underdog all season, and they boast a roster full of athletes who like to play with a chip on their shoulder. Well, that chip is now the size of a boulder. He acknowledged in Monday's news conference that his team would be the underdog, no matter which team it faces. But this underdog team is an easy one to support. ASU went from 3-9, and a program under the cloud of an investigation, to conference champion in 1 year. It has a coach in Coach Dillingham who has energized a fan base that had been apathetic and disillusioned by the sins of the previous coaching regime. ASU serves as a good example to other programs going through struggles that redemption can come quickly, although it doesn't come easily. The Big 12 needs ASU to make a statement. Who knows what team might become the ASU of 2025 and possibly face the same discrimination? An hour before Saturday's game kicked off, Commissioner Brett Yormark was asked about elevating the brand of the schools in his conference, so they're not just an afterthought this time next season. He admitted that was something about which he and his administration will have serious discussions. Arizona State needs big-time support from its conference peers, whose cause would be helped dramatically by more stunning success from the Sun Devils. And that was the article entitled, Big 12 Should Be Rooting for ASU. Next up, from inside the sports section, we have an article entitled Suns Look to Build Home Record with 3-Game Stand. This was written by Dwayne Rankin for the Arizona Republic. The Phoenix Suns begin a 3-game homestand Sunday against the Portland Trail Blazers. The Suns are 1-0 against the Blazers this season. They won 103-97 on November 2nd at Footprint Center. Devin Booker posted 28 points and 9 assists as Phoenix rolled to an 8-1 start to the season. The Suns then face the Indiana Pacers on Thursday and the Detroit Pistons on Saturday at home. The Pacers are having a down season after reaching the Eastern Conference Finals last season, while the Pistons have shown improvement under their new head coach, J.B. Bickerstaff, who replaced former Suns head coach Monty Williams. The Suns are 8-4 at home this season, winning their past two, November 30th against Golden State by 113-105, and on December 3rd versus San Antonio by a score of 104-93. They are 3-1 in their past 4 outings at Footprint Center. Having a dominant home court often plays a huge role in a successful season. The Boston Celtics posted the NBA's best home record last season, 37 wins and 4 losses in their championship season. The Denver Nuggets had the league's top home mark at 34-7 when they won it all back in the 22-23 season. The Suns held that distinction in the 2021 and 2022 season when they won a franchise-best 64 games under Williams, who won the NBA Coach of the Year that season. They racked up the NBA's top home record at 32-9 in earning home court advantage throughout the playoffs. They were the only team with single-digit defeats at home in that 21-22 regular season. But unlike Boston and Denver, the Suns fell short of winning an NBA championship. Ironically, Phoenix's season ended with a home meltdown against Dallas with a score of 123-90. And that was in Game 7 of the Western Conference semifinals at Footprint Center. The Suns have racked up 135 consecutive home sellout crowds, and that counts the playoffs dating clear back to December 19th, 2021. Now, they haven't been as successful at home in the two seasons following that 32-9 run in 21 and 22, but their fans have seen many more wins than losses. Phoenix finished 28 wins and 13 losses at home in the 22-23 regular season. The Suns lost their final game of the season at home to the Nuggets, 125-100, in Game 6 of the Western Conference semifinals. The Suns fired Williams after that season and hired Frank Vogel to replace him. Last season, Phoenix went 25-16 at home under Vogel in the regular season, but they were 0-2 at Footprint Center in the postseason. The Minnesota Timberwolves swept the Suns in the first round, taking Game 4 by 6 points, 102-116, at Footprint Center. And that was the article by Dwayne Rankin, Suns Look to Build Home Record with 3-Game Stand. Our next article was written by Nancy Armour, who is a columnist for the USA Today, and it's entitled Clark Speaks Her Mind on Race Privilege. It's been a bad couple of days for the racist and the bigots who thought that Caitlin Clark was one of them. First, Clark said she recognizes that there is an element of white privilege to her stardom, that the black women who laid the foundation for this current explosion in interest in women's sports were never afforded a spotlight as bright and intense as the one that shines on her. And then, when conservative crank Megyn Kelly criticized her for saying that, Clark doubled down. Wednesday, when asked about Kelly's comments, Clark said, quote, "I feel like I've earned every single thing that's happened to me over the course of my career. But also, I grew up a fan of this league from a very young age. My favorite player was Maya Moore. I know what this league is about." Unquote. Moore was transcendent when she was dominant in the WNBA. She led the Lynx to 4 titles and won MVP honors in the 2014 season and in the WNBA Finals of 2013. And if you add in her Olympic gold medals and titles and Player of the Year honors at UConn, she is quite possibly the best there's ever been. But Moore's impact went beyond the court as a cornerstone of the WNBA's social justice efforts. She and the Lynx were among the first athletes to protest the racist policing of black and brown people, and she retired early to work on reversing the wrongful conviction of the man who is now her husband. Clark has talked often of the influence that Moore had on her, and it is clear she just didn't mean on the court. Caitlin Clark said, "Like I said, the WNBA has only been around 25-plus years. I know there's been so many amazing black women that have been in this league, and continuing to uplift them, I think, is very important. That's something I'm very aware of." Unquote. And she said that at the Year in Time event, where she was named Time's Athlete of the Year. Now, few athletes, especially at a young age, can be as thoughtful or as direct as LeBron James and the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team in calling out hate and the marginalization of minorities. And that seemed during the season to include Clark, whose criticism of the racism and homophobia spewed at other WNBA players by some people claiming to be their fans often came only when she was asked directly about it. But if those lowlifes, like the woman who wrote Clark's number on the paper talons that she wore to a playoff game to mock black players, thought that they had Clark's tacit approval, they are now seeing just how wrong they are. And so, too, those who thought that Clark was too naive to understand why what was being done and said in her name was so problematic. She saw it. She saw all of it, and she wants no part of it. Clark told Time in the Player of the Year story, quote, "I want to say I've earned us every single thing. but as a white person, there is privilege. A lot of those players in the league that have been really good have been black players. This league was kind of been built on them. The more we can appreciate that, highlight that, talk about that, and then continue to have brands and companies invest in those players that have made this league incredible, I think it's very important. I have to continue to try to change that. The more we can elevate black women, that's going to be a beautiful thing. Unquote. Well, this isn't self-flagellation, as Kelly sneered, and this isn't condescending or fake. This is a young woman recognizing that while, yes, she has worked her ass off to get where she is, and she deserves every bit of the spotlight that she commands, she is also the beneficiary of a society that continues to give white people primacy. People like Clark, and unfortunately there are many like her these days, seem to think it's a character flaw to acknowledge that. That if they recognize privilege exists, it means they aren't deserving of what they've accomplished. That if they say privilege is real, they aren't as exceptional as they think. Which could be true. But privilege is simply the recognition that if you are white, male, or appear to be cisgender, society unconsciously gives you a head start. It is why a white person can walk into a store and be greeted with a smile, and a black person gets followed around. It is why a man is assumed to be capable of doing a job, and a woman is deemed to be unqualified no matter what her resume says. It is why someone who appears to be straight can live their life without judgment, while someone who is gay or transgender has their body and life policed. It is why a straight white woman who can knock down logo threes at will is celebrated, and black women who are equally talented and charismatic play in the shadows, particularly black women who are also LGBTQ. Women's basketball is already better for Caitlin Clark. Her comments this week are an indication the world will be too. While that might outrage Kelly and some other of her so-called fans, it will do more proud. And that was the article, Clark Speaks Her Mind on Race Privilege. Our next article from the interior of the sports section was written by Bob McManaman. He's a columnist for the Arizona Republic. ASU football Peach Bowl president rose from the ashes. Peaches might be out of season in Georgia this time of year, and Chick-fil-A isn't open on Sundays, but nothing fills the void better than having the Arizona State Sun Devils in the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl. So says Gary P. Stokin, the CEO and president of the Peach Bowl, where ASU will continue its surreal season on January 1st with a date in the college football playoff quarterfinals at the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta. Quote, "We're really excited about Arizona State," Stokin said of the Devils, who will meet the winner of Saturday's first-round game between 5th-seeded Texas and 12th-seeded Clemson. He went on and said, quote, "There are so many stories, as you know, between Kenny Dillingham and what he's done, how young he is, and being an Arizona State guy, to Cam Scadabo, to Sam Leavitt, to Coach Arroyo, the offensive coordinator, who's up for the Broyles Award as the nation's top assistant. I mean, there are so many different stories, and it is all deserving. To be coming from the Pac-12 to the Big 12, to be picked to finish last, and to win the Big 12, it is an amazing story. It is appropriate that Arizona State is just like the Phoenix coming out of the ashes. There's your headline right there. But it's true. Where they've come from in the last few years to where they are at now, it's just unbelievable," unquote. And Stokin should know. He has risen from the ashes himself a time or two during his 43 years of executive corporate sports management experience, which included a pair of stints with Adidas. He came close to signing Michael Jordan to a long-term shoe deal that would have stopped Nike in its tracks. A bench player from the North Carolina State basketball team in the mid-70s, who later coached under Norm Sloan for 3 years as an assistant, Stokin had a chance to follow Sloan to Florida or stay with the Wolfpack under the incoming coach Jim Valvano. He turned them both down. Stokin, who is 69, recalled and said, quote, I had seen some of the steamier sides of recruiting and bags of money changing hands. Now it's legal because of NIL deals, but back then it was illegal. I really enjoyed recruiting, getting to know the grandmother and the girlfriend and the dog and everybody else, but I wasn't going to cheat. So I decided to get out of coaching at 25, and I went to work for Adidas in their Southeast office, unquote. Well, a few years later, he met Jordan, who was preparing to play for the U.S. men's basketball team in the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. That was under Indiana coach Bobby Knight. Stokin had signed Knight to a deal with Adidas, and he did the same with Jordan, who became a member of the last amateur-level team to win a gold medal in men's basketball. During a phone call conference interview from his Atlanta office, Stokin said, I gave Michael the first pair of $100 basketball shoes in the U.S. market, called the Forum. I'm staring at pictures right now with Michael wearing those shoes. Dean Smith wouldn't let him wear Adidas in games at North Carolina because Dean was getting $250,000 from Converse. But Michael would wear Adidas all around campus. He would even practice in them. But then Nike came calling, as Jordan was about to begin his NBA career. His agent and his father implored Michael to accept the $2.5 million endorsement deal. But he was leaning heavily toward joining the Adidas brand full-time. He called Stokin and asked for a meeting, where they met and sat on the fabled stone wall at North Carolina's campus in Chapel Hill. Stokin recalled and said, Michael looked at me and he said, Mr. Stokin, I love you. You've been great to me and my family, and I love Adidas' products. If you can get close, just get close to Nike's deal. I will sign with Adidas. Well, Stokin drew up a proposal, sent it to Adidas headquarters in Germany, but he was told the company didn't have that kind of money to put in the U.S. market. Alas, Adidas missed out on winning the shoe war, which was fought in the United States and not in Europe. Nike was in the red, but signing Jordan changed everything. Stokin said Michael sells $126 million of Air Jordan products in his rookie year. That puts Nike in the black now, and Michael's business, the Jordan brand, is doing $7 billion worth of business annually. If we signed Michael, Nike would have been out of business. There might not even be a Nike if we had signed Michael. Well, if they had, Stokin said, quote, I would have retired in the Bahamas a long time ago, unquote. Stokin moved on to Converse, where he extended Magic Johnson and Larry Bird contracts, among others. But losing out on Jordan, however, turned out to be a great thing for the Peach Bowl, because Stokin has overseen that since 1998. As the longtime head of the Atlanta Sports Council, it was also great for Atlanta, which hosted the 1996 Olympics, and they'll host the fourth Super Bowl in 2028, and they've been home to Final Fours and MLB and NHL All-Star Games. So in addition to hosting the Peach Bowl, the CFP title game will be held at Mercedes-Benz Stadium on January 20th. And that could be Arizona State's Michael Jordan moment. If the Sun Devils win the Peach Bowl in 2.5 weeks and win the Cotton Bowl the week after that, they will have seized an opportunity that no one will ever forget. To go from NCAA sanctions and probations, a bowl ban and consecutive 3-9 finishes, to a national title appearance. It's that close now for this overachieving football program. Stokin said, oh man, can you imagine? The experience they will have when they walk into that stadium with a sold-out crowd and an electric atmosphere and playing to represent their university and a conference and their families in a national championship, it would be an awesome experience. Well, the Sun Devils are evolving, just like the Peach Bowl, which was founded in 1968 by George Crumbly Jr. He was a member of the Lions Club. He made the Peach Bowl the first charity bowl organization in the country. and over the years, it has provided $64 million to charity and scholarship funds. ASU appeared in the third Peach Bowl back in 1970 under Coach Frank Cush. The game was played at Georgia Tech's Bobby Dodd Stadium, and the Sun Devils destroyed North Carolina coach Bill Dooley's Tar Heels by 48-26. Stokin said of the longtime Georgia coach and brother of Bill Dooley, he said, "Vince Dooley was on the sidelines for that game in 1970, and he told me, 'Gary, I was never so cold in all my life.' He said, 'I've been on a lot of football fields, but it rained in the first quarter, sleeted in the second quarter, snowed in the third quarter, and iced in the fourth quarter.' He said, 'A little bit after halftime, I had to leave my brother and go home because I was so cold.'" Well, as the story goes, ASU boosters and executives were so cold themselves that they realized, "Hey, it's 80 degrees in Phoenix today. Why don't we start one of those bowl games?" Well, according to Stokin, the powers that be huddled with Peach Bowl officials, and the Fiesta Bowl was born in 1971. And that was the article by Bob McManaman, ASU football Peach Bowl president rose from the ashes. We're at just past 36 minutes past the hour. I think we better go find an opinion piece to read. Here's an opinion piece written by Phil Boas. He's a columnist for the Arizona Republic. It's entitled, "Killing of CEO, No Time to Trash Healthcare." He writes this, "Are we really going to go there? Because if that's where we are as a country, then the most important story on the shooting death of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson was reported by the Wall Street Journal. I've been telling everyone I know to read it. Are we really going to launch a national gripe session about U.S. healthcare because someone shot a healthcare executive in the back, gunned him down on a New York sidewalk, murdered him? The Journal's big scoop? Brian Thompson was a human being. While some of you were airing your own grievances about health insurance and managed care, Journal writers Anna Wild Matthews and Valerie Borodine were telling the story of Thompson, a son of rural Iowa who grew up where corn fills the horizon. He was a son, a husband, a father of two boys who became known for his ferocious determination to succeed, and a second quality that seldom tags along with such ambition. You see, he was cordial and kind. He was the son of an elevator man. For 40 years, his father worked in those giant silos where they scoop grain for farmers, according to Wild Matthews and Bauerlein reporting. His dad was also a family man, raising kids in little Jewel, Iowa, population 1,200. He loved taking his boys, Brian and Mark, fishing at a nearby gravel pit. Last year, the father passed away. And at his funeral, Brian remembered how his father loved to tell stories. He said some of those stories were a little embellished. Those were the fishing ones, of course. Thompson was the valedictorian and homecoming king who went on to the University of Iowa and achieved the highest grade point average in his college class. From this patchwork of memories came more about a boy at South Hamilton High School who so impressed his teachers 30 years ago that they have not forgotten him, according to the Wall Street Journal reporters. South Hamilton's principal, Todd Coy, told the reporters, "I've done this for 37 years, and he's one that is on that Mount Rushmore. Just a great kid." The Wall Street Journal profile is rich with detail and humanity. That's the discussion this killing should provoke, the theft of life, not just any life, but extraordinary life. One of the best among us. That's not the discussion many Americans want to have. They think the murder of Brian Thompson's an excellent vehicle to nurse their grievances about the U.S. health care. Their rationale? Well, the system is so defective that it provoked one of its patients to murder a health care executive. Now, this particular point of view does not break cleanly along political lines. People both left and right have played the apologist to the accused killer by merely hinting that he may have had a point. After all, our healthcare system is dysfunctional. We can go there with that discussion, but understand that it is poison to civilized society. When we pivot from the merciless slaying of a healthcare executive to the resentments of his killer, whether we intended to or not, we have rewarded the deed. Should you doubt that, then let me suggest where your logic leads. Are you comfortable with this? A religious zealot kills a doctor who performs abortions? Before the doctor is even buried, millions of Americans suggest the killer had a point, that there are too many abortions in this country, more than 600,000 a year. One talk show promotes its next episode with the title Abortion, Health Care, or Birth Control. Or imagine last election that one of Donald Trump's would-be assassins was actually successful. While Melania and Barron prepare for the funeral, a national conversation began about the fascist tendencies of the Republican nominee. That's where we are. We are telling the grieving wife and sons of Brian Thompson that America is having a conversation about the evils of U.S. healthcare and the people who manage it. It would have been nice to have Brian here to defend himself and his industry, but his judge, jury, and executioner settled that. And that was Phil Boas' opinion piece entitled, Killings of CEO, No Time to Trash Healthcare. We have a couple of minutes left in this section. Let's read some opinions from people like you and me in the Letters to the Editor. Our first letter goes like this. Phoenix leaders have accused state government of pulling a fast one and hampering the city's efforts to address the affordable housing crisis. When it comes to the lack of affordable housing, those city leaders would do better addressing the law of supply and demand rather than casting stones and making excuses. Residential properties that otherwise would be available for full-time occupancy have been taken off the supply side of the housing market by being converted into short-term rentals that are owned and operated in large measure by out-of-state residents and corporations. Well, the appropriate remedial action is not complicated. All the city needs to do is impose a significant transaction privilege tax on rentals of fewer than 30 days. Doing that would have the dual benefit of bolstering the city's finances and increasing the Phoenix housing supply, not to mention taking a meaningful step to dampen the harm that short-term rentals inflict on the tranquility of residential neighborhoods and on the property values of residences near them. This letter was signed by Eugene D. Cohen from Phoenix. Our next letter goes, I am aware that when Greg Moore stated there was no way that Arizona State University could defeat Iowa State, it was his opinion. I think now that ASU has proven they can defeat Iowa State, they deserve more from you than a sorry song. Signed, Gary Dippy from Phoenix. Our next letter goes, Yes, we are grateful for the tireless efforts of election workers, as former Governor Jan Brewer stated, but she is naive when she references this year's elections and writes, quote, thanks to the diligence of our election officials, voters can have confidence that the process was fair and transparent, unquote. Democrats have always believed in the integrity of our electoral process. After all, Hillary Clinton conceded to Donald Trump in 2016 as soon as the election results were known, and Al Gore conceded to George Bush in 2000 after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled Florida must quit counting ballots. There were no demonstrations. There was no insurrection at the Capitol. Kamala Harris conceded this year for the same reason. She lost. And in Maricopa County, after running a smooth election in 2020, County Recorder Adrian Fontes, a Democrat, conceded in 2020 to Stephen Richer, a Republican, just as Richer conceded to MAGA's Justin Heap after this year's Republican primary, and Democrat Tim Stringham conceded to Heap after the November 5th election. Does anyone really think that our MAGA neighbors would have accepted anything less than a win this year? Even now, we are hearing from Republicans who want vengeance against the officials who somehow rigged the presidential election in 2020. I just hope that Jan Brewer is prepared to write an opinion piece defending election officials if and when those officials are threatened or even charged with baseless crimes after Trump takes office. Signed, Jane McNamara in Phoenix. We are now at 45 minutes past the hour, so we're going to move on over to the entertainment section. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. So if you were born between March 21st and April 19th, you were born under the sign of Aries. And here is your horoscope. You have arrived. Is it all that you dreamed it would be? The Gemini full moon stirs up mixed feelings. For Taurus, April 20th to May 20th birth dates, you get what you desire, but it may not be enough. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, today's full moon falls in Gemini. Relationship conflicts and business blunders prompt a wake-up call. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, are you taking time to integrate the lessons learned? Pause and reflect on your progress. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, your creative work could use a peer review. Today facilitates a productive dialogue. And for you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd. Are you showing what you have got? A bright idea thrust you into the professional spotlight. Then we have Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birth dates. Talking up your message is not enough. You must put it into practice. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates. Are you giving back? You have been in manifesting mode for the past 2 weeks. Now it's time to share the wealth. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, are you willing to collaborate? Because you can't do it all by yourself. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, are you getting organized? Because it's time to get down to business. And Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, perform and present. Don't hold back. And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Are you prioritizing your personal life? Work takes a back seat today. Give a family matter your full attention. And that was the horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. Our first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been married less than a year, and I am pregnant with my first child. Our baby was planned, and we were thrilled. Something changed with my husband once I hit the second trimester. If I read something about pregnancy and try to share it with him, he instantly shuts me down, saying I shouldn't believe everything I read or that I'm wasting my time. He doesn't want to set up anything in the nursery either. He keeps saying we don't need to do it until a month before the baby is due. I'm trying to be patient and understanding, but friends have now taken a step back from talking to me. I'm feeling very isolated. The other night, my husband put me down at dinner with friends. One of them said being pregnant was the most selfish thing a woman could do, and my husband agreed. I am still hurt by the comment. While the person apologized for saying it and further explained their position on the subject, because everyone had been drinking except me, my husband hasn't apologized. He refuses and says I'm idiotic for being so upset about it. I am at a loss here. We planned for this baby. I thought it would even bring us even closer. But now I feel incredibly alone and sad. Why would anyone say something so cruel? And why would my husband agree instead of being on my side? Signed, Expecting More in New Jersey. And Abby responds, Dear Expecting, pregnancy is an exciting and challenging experience for all concerned. and your emotions may be heightened. Although your husband was initially enthusiastic about the idea of starting a family right away, it's possible that during this second trimester, he recognized the reality of the responsibilities that come with parenthood. It is also possible that because of your excitement about your pregnancy, it has become your main topic of conversation, which may be why your friends have stepped back. The remark that was made the evening the two of you were with friends was likely fueled by too much alcohol and not enough good judgment. Your husband may have agreed because he feels jealous that your body has been co-opted by the baby. But not knowing him, I just can't guess at why he continues to refuse to apologize for it. It seems to me you would feel less isolated if you found an older, more experienced female friend or relative to guide you through this challenging period. Also, keep up with your medical appointments. Make sure everything is progressing normally. And that was the letter to Abigail Van Buren. Remember, Dear Abby, the column is written by Abigail Van Buren, who is also known as Jean Phillips, and the column was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. And you can contact Abigail one of two ways. You can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can mail her a letter to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069 is the zip code. And that was today's Letter to Dear Abby. Now we'll turn to a couple of comics. In the comic strip Zits, that was drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, it's labeled Finals Week, and it's divided into two panels. And in the left panel, the girls are studying for finals. And one of them has a tray and is approaching the other one and says, "Okay, we have herbal tea, veggie sticks, a scented candle, and good lighting." And the other girl says, "Ooh, let's study." And on the other side, in the other frame, there's Jeremy and his friend Pierce sitting on the couch playing video games, open pizza box in front of him. And Jeremy says, "Ask me a review question." And Pierce says, "Well, after we wipe out these zombies." And that was Zits. In Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, Sergeant Snorkels in the office, sitting at his desk. And behind him is Lieutenant Fuzz, sitting at his desk. And the Sergeant Snorkel's chair squeaks. And Lieutenant Fuzz says, "Stop making that noise." And Sergeant Snorkel says, "What noise?" As he squeak, squeak, squeak his chair. And in the next frame, Lieutenant Noise comes over and says, "That noise!" As his Sergeant Snorkel keeps his chair squeak, squeak, squeak. And Sergeant Snorkel says, "I don't hear anything." And in the next frame, Lieutenant Fuzz is really angry. He's waving his arms. He says, "Do you want me to show you what it sounds like?" And Sergeant Snorkel says, "Be my guest." And then in the next frame, Lieutenant Fuzz yells out, "Squeak!" And in the next office over, one of the officers says, "What was that?" And General Halftrack says, "It sounded like a giant moose being murdered." And that was Beetle Bailey. In the comic strip Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, Dagwood's sitting on a park bench or a picnic bench, but it looks like it's in a shopping mall. And here comes Blondie with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Christmas gifts wrapped or a bag or two. And she says, "I'm going to leave these here with you, dear." And the next frame, here she comes with some more. And she says, "Almost done, honey." And then she turns and walks away, and as she's walking away, she says, "I just need to pick up a few more things." And then, here she comes back with two more bags. There's this stack of stuff sitting next to Dagwood on the bench. And she says, "The Christmas shopping is all done." And she puts her hands on her hips and looks at him and says, "All good things come to those who wait." And the last frame, Dagwood says, "Well, that's a matter of opinion." As Blondie walks down the sidewalk ahead of him, carrying two bags, one in each hand, and he's carrying two bags, one in each hand, plus 9 packages on his arms and in front of his neck, and it looks like maybe on top of his head. Anyway, that was Blondie. In Peanuts, drawn by Schultz, featuring good old Charlie Brown, his sister, Sally, is holding a piece of paper up, and she says, "I can't believe it." And then in the next frame, she's writing, and Charlie Brown is sitting there looking at her. And she writes, "Dear Santa Claus, I saw a picture of you in the paper today. You sure are getting fat. You look like you just ate all your reindeer. You're going to be sorry next summer when you can't get into your swim trunks. Get out of Scarf City before it is too late. I am enclosing a special diet for you. Stick to it." And then she's licking the envelope, and she's put the letter in the envelope, and she's licking the ledge to shut it up, and she says to Charlie Brown, "He'll probably hate me, but it's for his own good." And in the last frame, Charlie Brown looks at her and says, "Well, the rest of us who also love him, thank you." And that was Peanuts. Before we go, we want to say happy birthday, Cindy Birdsong, the singer from the Supremes. She turns 85 today. Drummer and band leader Dave Clark also turns 85. Actor Don Johnson turns 75 today. The director Julie Taymor turns 72. Guitarist and singer Tim Reynolds from the Dave Matthews Band, he turns 67 today. Congratulations to all of them. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, December 15th. Have a great day. Bye-bye.